Biodynamics is very labor intensive.
You're listening to your community radio station, KKCR Hanalei, KAQA Kilauea, K224CQ in Molawa'a, and K284AL in beautiful Hala'iva. It's time for In the Garden on the Farm.
Aloha, and welcome to In the Garden on the Farm, your weekly radio program that cultivates the passion and knowledge to grow well with plants and animals. We're your hosts, Robin and Paul, and on today's show, we'll enjoy a few interviews from a documentary film on biodynamic agriculture. But first, we'd like to let you know that this KKCR program is made possible by listeners like you, in partnership with our fine sponsors.
Aloha, Robin.
Aloha, Paul.
Beautiful to see you. Well, I'm really excited about the show today. We've been thinking a lot about biodynamics with your sharing of on the Celestial Session each and every week, and working on compost recently. There are so many ways in which biodynamic knowledge improves what we do, and here's a great opportunity to be informed even more.
Yeah, just to give a little backstory, Rudolf Steiner is considered the father of biodynamics, and his work was developing in the late 19th century into the early 20th century. Steiner gave a famous set of agricultural lectures in 1924, which changed the face of organic agriculture forever. His inspiration lives on today as biodynamic agriculture across the planet.
And thanks to Jonathan Stettel, who is a documentary filmmaker, he has presented to us the challenge of Rudolf Steiner. You can find out more information about this film at rudolfsteinerfilm.squarespace.com. We're going to listen to a few excerpts from it right now, starting off with Stefan Schneider and Emily Kozakowicz from Hawthorne Valley Farm in New York. Enjoy.
How realistic is it as a form of agriculture for the future? I mean, or is it just going to be a sort of luxury for those who can afford more expensive food? And
That's a great question. Wow, yes. I mean, and that's a question that I get asked every so often. Is this realistic? Is this real? Can it really provide food for the world? And my answer is yes. And I think a couple of things need to come in play from my point of view. One is we have to, again, kind of realize that food plays a really important role in our lives, in our culture, in our economies, and I think we have to value it more in our own personal lives. And so as a result, I think we might have to be willing to spend a little more of our disposable income on food. And secondly, I quite believe that in order for this lot of the ills that bother the planet Earth and humanity, we need to make agriculture attractive again to young people, and we need a few more people working in agriculture. I mean, in this part of the world, is maybe, I know it's less than 2%, and I don't think that's going to do it. You know, and the other thing that I always say when I get asked this question is, well, you know, the so-called model, or the so-called industrial model, or the modern model of agriculture isn't doing it either. You know, the food that's being produced, you can argue about its qualities, and certainly it's not doing anything good to the earth. So I feel we do need a new approach, and I certainly think biodynamics has a lot to offer in that direction. And just recently, many reports from the UN, and there's a World Agricultural Report that came out, they all stress what they call agroecological approach. A diversified farm, medium size, is the answer. And I mean, in my mind, that's another way of saying biodynamics.
But why they said that?
Well, because that's, I think, the only way you can really treat the earth appropriately and grow food that's healthy and, you know, doesn't kill anything in its path. And I mean, the other thing is, with the resources running out, you have to, I think, create farming organisms that can sort of basically be self-sustaining. And I feel that's the beauty, and I really credit Rudolf Steiner for really making that so clear, that the basic, entity unit around which I think from where everything is going to grow is this farm organism. And then building those farm organisms, then, you know, everything else goes from there in my mind. So So I believe that's the one thing I really credit him. And the other thing I credit him with that he made it that's so clear in his lectures on agriculture is that he places agriculture front and center at the base of all culture and economy. And, you know, we have to learn that again in the Western world. In other parts of the world, that's still, I think, more recognized, although there, people are also fleeing the rural areas. So if that's, you know, that's my long-winded answer to your question.
Yeah. Would you like to say something about the agricultural course, how that came about and what he... Because that's quite a while ago, isn't it?
Yes. It's getting on to 100 years now. It's almost 90 years ago. And I've encountered those lectures. Oh man, it's long, many years ago, 30 years ago maybe now almost, scarily enough. And when I first read them, I certainly didn't understand most of it. But they nevertheless inspired me, and it seemed at least the way I was resonating with some of the content, it really then gave me sort of the energy to pursue this vocation.
Were you a farmer already then?
No, I'm what I call the... sort of a new style of farmer. Most people that I encounter that are going into farming now do not come from a farming background, and so neither did I. I come from a sort of German urban type, small urban background, and I was inspired by an biodynamic farmer who gave a presentation to high school graduates, and I was among them. And when I listened to him, I said I'd like to do that, and then I actually studied agriculture, and then I went into farming.
Yeah.
So that was my path.
Yeah.
But those lectures clearly inspired me then, and they're so deep and so encompassing that they inspire me to date. And every time I pick them up, I find new kernels of wisdom in there, so they're just wonderful.
How do you explain biodynamics to somebody who maybe has a sense of what organic agriculture is about?
Mm-hmm.
But... yeah,
right. Well, I would say the way I would explain it is I think it's the most holistically comprehensive way of looking at agriculture that I've ever encountered. I think, like I said, the two elements that I pointed out before is one, really placing it in its appropriate spot in our society, and then really building and developing a relationship to the farm as a living, feeling, sensing organism and individuality. And I think there may be that sort of that conscious attempt and view of the farm as a being that it can become. I think that's where it might differ from sort of a more just organic approach. So trying to fit the various parts of the farm together and then viewing it as a being, really, with various organs and parts and
so you're talking about a mixed farm, then?
Absolutely.
Rather than a monoculture.
It has to be a mixed farm. So, and so as a result, you'll have a diverse farm. Livestock, I think, will be an integral part of that. And it'll be appropriately shaped according to where it is on this planet.
So it's healthier, is it, if it's a mixed farm? It's healthier.
Well, I think it's healthier, and it's really only it's the only way to farm sustainably in my mind. I don't think you can farm sustainably in a monoculture. It's completely against any natural rule out here in the world. There is no monoculture if you let nature do its thing.
So animals, for example, cows, are not just there for their milk then, is that right? Or your beef, they're not just there for food?
Well, when I tour people through the barn, I sometimes sort of beg the question, I ask them, why do you think we have cows? And then, they say, the butter and the milk. And then because I've asked it, I mean, maybe often enough, they come to the answer that I'm looking for. And the reason we have cows, really, truthfully, is because of their manure. The milk is really a byproduct. I consider a byproduct, we wouldn't survive without it. But the farm would clearly survive and thrive just with the manure. So we keep ruminants, and the cows are sort of being the crown jewel of ruminants because of their manure, because of that magic that they do in their digestion. And so the black gold, as we call it. The big pile here of black gold becoming right behind us.
Going back with biodynamics, I asked you for a sort of definition, as it were, of biodynamics. I mean, and in relation to what people understand by organic,
mm-hmm.
There is this whole dimension, as I understand it, of not just sun and moon,
right?
the cosmos.
The whole cosmos.
Yeah.
Right. So, I mean, that's the other thing I feel that biodynamics sort of takes. I mean, I think anybody who farms deals with those things, but they're not conscious of it. Meaning that these forces that come to the earth from the cosmos, and not just the sun. I mean, the sun is sort of the apparent one. We couldn't farm without the sun. But there's other planets up there, and actually they're really beings. So they're not just dead planets, but you can imagine them as beings or home of beings. And they have an influence of what's going on here. And then really, you know, it's so clearly stated. And actually it's something I carry around as a reminder. You know, Steiner points that out. He says, you know, you have, look at the compass. You would never try to figure out why this compass does what it does by sort of taking it apart. But you can only understand what it does in the context of the whole Earth. And so he says you can't understand the plant unless you understand it in the context of the whole cosmos, including all the planets and the fixed stars. And I think, you know, that's just a truthful fact. And our senses aren't developed enough, and mine neither, that we can't really, I mean, we're clear on the sun, and we're even clear on the moon. It has clear effects on this Earth, on the water bodies of the Earth. And we can pick up the energies, the forces coming from Venus, Mars, Jupiter, Saturn, but they're there, clearly there. So that's, you know, so you really feel yourself part of this amazing creation, and it's really a privilege actually to work in farming. And my latest sort of enthusiasm is how can one make this viscerally understandable to young people. You know, I'd love to inspire more and more young people to get into agriculture. I mean, we need it. All of us will be in trouble in 10, 15 years if we don't achieve that goal.
Are you experiencing more and more young people coming towards agriculture?
Well, you know, a place like Hawthorne Valley, you're in a little bit in an unusual bubble. In a place like here, yes. You know, we work with 6 to 8 young people every year. Some of them stay for 2 years, and they're all... And many of them, if you follow them, they actually go into farming. So, yes. But if you look on the scale in this country, I would say no. The average age of the farmer is still upwards of 55. So it's not quite there yet.
What is it about biodynamics that appeals to you, Ben?
Well, for me, I was interested in agriculture and sustainability. And what I like about biodynamics is that there's a real element of healing and of a human interaction with the earth, and sort of working as best we can to give back more than we take and to be participating in healing the earth.
Healing the earth, yes.
Yeah.
Do you find that many people, your friends, for example, think it's all a bit weird, biodynamics, or not?
A lot of my friends don't think it's weird. They actually... it's something that really resonates with them, and there's elements of it that can seem a little funny from the outside, but once you take the time to sort of explain what's going on as far as I can understand it, then it usually resonates with people, and they get at least more intrigued or interested in it.
I mean, there is a concern about not only what we're doing to the earth, but what we're eating, isn't there, generally?
Yeah, definitely. Yeah,
I think that the tragic situation here is we've pushed farming, agriculture. We've sort of considered a fringe economic. It's become a fringe economic activity to produce food as cheaply as possible. That's the sad, tragic reality. And I think we have to reshift our view and say this is a cultural activity, really, that has economic impact. But it really is maybe first and foremost a cultural activity and a deed towards this planet. But in order for farmers to survive, the economic, you know, equivalent has to be there. But I mean, I think maybe just because I really believe our actions really, you know, they come out one way or the other depending on how we are what our motives are. And so if we can really do that and don't do it because of economic motivation, farming, maybe then also that'll help. If we really don't do it because of that, but we do it because we want to worship this earth with our labor. That's really boils right down to that, maybe.
The film we're making, it's called The Challenge of Rudolf Steiner. It's not just a film about biodynamics, but that's a very important element in the film. But what would you say was the challenge or the greatest challenges in relation to Rudolf Steiner's life and what he tried to bring?
Wow.
Nice, easy question.
That's a big question. we had a little celebration when, you know, it was 150 years since Steiner's birth. And his biggest challenge, wow. Well, I think in many ways he was so far ahead of his times that I think in many ways it was hard for his contemporaries to really, really get what he was after. I feel maybe now, 150 years later, I think it might be easier for us to really, I mean, maybe not, I shouldn't say that, but maybe it's a little easier for us to really understand what he was after. And sometimes I think if Rudolf Steiner would does he look back, let's put it this way, does he look back on his life and sometimes wonder if all these lectures should have been written down? Because I find a bit of the tragic and maybe a challenge then for his work too is I feel sometimes we spend too much time trying to interpret and argue about slight nuances that the way he expressed his insights in these lectures, and we aren't just trying to get to work, either, you know, dealing with each other as human beings or dealing with the earth or dealing with children or whatever. And that's a bit of a tragic thing I see, and I wonder what he would say about that. But I think his basic challenge, I would think he was so far, I mean, I think the picture of agriculture that he gives is going to be valid for hundreds and hundreds of years still, for us to really grasp it. And then certainly the real challenge for all of us is develop the insight and develop the capacities to really see what he described. You know, it's not good enough to just be able to recount it. We'll have to be able to see it.
Some people see what he was bringing, for example, in relation to agriculture, as really drawing on what we always knew instinctively but had forgotten. I mean, do you think that that's a good description, or do you think it's more than that then?
Well, I think certainly, and I think even Steiner even describes that in his lectures, is clearly one aspect is that this sort of inherent wisdom, peasant wisdom, if you might say that, is lost with a modern human consciousness. And I think many of these farmers that still have that, they have some of these insights, you know, they just have them and they act almost unconsciously out of them. Now, that's really not going to happen. That's not really going to be enough for a Western mind. But I think in many ways also, I think he's expanded the picture. You know, he's expanded it. And my feeling is if I can really develop the capacities that he describes and describes sort of very, you know, it's really amazing. I look back over my life and I'm kind of thinking, gee whiz, now I'm, you know, over 50. Why has it taken me that long to really understand this rigor of self work on one's own, this rigor of working with one's own individuality, that is really a rigor. And it's really only sort of slowly sinking in now. But I think that's kind of what he's been asking of us. And then if one could do that, I think then we will be able to have our own insights. And then, you know, who knows? But I mean, then the picture will expand again.
That was Stefan Snyder and Emily Kozakowicz from Hawthorne Valley Farm in New York. And next, we're going to listen to Heidi Herman of the Natural Beekeeping Trust in Sussex, England.
We hear increasingly about the problems that bees are facing, and it's usually implied that there's some nasty bug from outside threatening them. But are we not ultimately the bug ourselves? I mean,
well, yes, the nastiest bug in the bee's life is the human being, and what is very difficult for the bees is the coldness of our approach towards them, a being of warmth and light, and the cold intellectual approach with which we generally as humanity approach nature, and in the case of the bees, the very sensitive bees, that can only lead to problems, and it has led to very, very clear problems which have manifested and are manifesting all over the place now.
Are we too greedy? Is that one of the problems in terms of what we take?
Yes, It's difficult to say anything for all of us, but yes, I think put on a very simple level, we are too greedy, we are too controlling, we are too detached from the living processes. And that doesn't work with bees. You cannot get on with bees. That is a lovely thing that Steiner said. He said, you will get on well with bees if you can relate to them from the level of your soul, from the level of your heart. But that is a very tall order. That we need to learn, I feel.
Yeah, yeah. But you've got many people now coming to you wanting to know more about bees. What is that? What is stirring in people, do you think?
I wonder, in my worst moments, I think it's a kind, it's maybe an 11th hour kind of feeling. People feel that it might be decision time, that we need to urgently mend our ways. Because the news of the colony collapse disorder in the United States, I think, has shaken many people up. But I think also people, once they get aware of how a colony lives and of the mysterious processes in colony life, something in their own deepest aspiration stirs. We're not lost. We all have these aspirations, and we have remnants of what we used to have, a much greater living and heart-filled connection with nature. And the bees hold a promise. They can show us a way.
And cooperation then is the key. Today.
Cooperation is the key.
Yeah.
Yes. Sharing.
Yeah.
Working for a higher goal.
Yes.
Is the key to that. And they, the marvelous thing is when you introduce bees and the way they work and the way they are to a great variety of people, how individual the bees' teaching can be. They seem to pick you up where you are. So there's no... We find that with our courses and with the people that we meet who want to find out about a more... I could say a more spiritual way of approaching the bees, that there's never any need to say anything too categorical, because the bees speak for themselves and they speak to people in different ways. That's the beauty of it. But what is very, very nice and encouraging is that people are not just interested in natural beekeeping. What is called natural beekeeping is a big umbrella term for a less controlling, less interventionist form of beekeeping. But people are interested in the deeper secrets of the bees. And there all you can say is patience. These secrets will not be... revealed if you are impatient and you cannot force anything out of the bees. Essentially, I think the bees are quite fed up with how they've been treated for 150 years. So we have to make a lot of amends. Does that make sense?
Yes. Do you want to say something about the queen? Because there is a move, isn't there, to create artificial queens, is that right?
Yes, artificial, that's actually very interesting because it relates to the history of Rudolf Steiner's so-called bee lectures. Artificial queen rearing had just started, maybe in 1900 or so. The bee lectures were held in 1923, 1924. And basically workers at the Goetheanum were asking Rudolf Steiner what he thought of that. And he simply said, you will get very good results because you can create great productivity, get more colonies, have control over how many colonies you have. But this will be quite short term. We must talk about it again in 60 years' time, and then you will no longer be happy. This bee is really wondering what I'm up to. No, it's a wasp, I think. Can you tell the difference? Sorry. And that time, the bees have basically collapsed on schedule with Rudolf Steiner's predictions. That is quite extraordinary. Colony collapse disorder, as you can date it exactly.
But we're still doing that, aren't we?
We're still doing that because we're very slow to learn. And... you know, artificial queen breeding is using an emergency process that the colony has developed in its wisdom to ensure bee survival and to make it the basis of breeding colonies. So 90%, I don't think I'm wrong in saying, of the bees now in the world are based on the breeding that the bees use in emergencies only. Completely mad. But we don't learn the lessons because we have great faith in science, which tries to learn about life by looking at what is dead. And I think as long as we use these scientific approaches to understand something living, especially something of a very elevated nature as the bees, we will not get anywhere. But we'll see how that will go. It's not looking great, but there are also many signs of hope.
Are these artificially created queens inferior then?
These artificially created queens are definitely inferior because the queen, one should really say the mother, the queen, she may be regal in her stature, but she has no power over the colony. The colony has the power. The queen carries out the colony's will. The colony decides everything. The queen is the mother of all the bees in the hive. And a bee queen that has arisen under natural circumstances, like the bees would do it, is a very superior creature because the bees will have made a selection and will have chosen the best of the young virgins, virgin embryos growing in the queen cells, to be the queen. Whereas if we take those decisions with not even a tiny part of the wisdom that a bee colony possesses, we can only go wrong, and we have gone spectacularly wrong. The queen is the carrier of the sexuality of the hive. A hive itself, what goes on in here and here, that is actually a completely sexuality-free zone. The one sexual act that takes place high up, maybe 150 meters high up towards the heavens, towards the sun, on a sunny day, with drones that are not necessarily from that hive. You know, you have to imagine that the sexual animals, the queen and the drones, they live together in here. They're milling around, but they're not at all interested in each other. They will leave the zone of the hive and mate up there somewhere and then return. And that's how you get good progeny. But as soon as we put our crude fingers and interfere with these processes of nature, we are not going to be successful in the long run. We can only ever have short-term success.
இது ஒரு கிரகணம். எல்லா கிரகங்களும் எதை சுத்தி போகுது? நம்ம சூரியனை சுத்தி போகுது. சரியா, இந்த சந்திரன் வந்து பூமியை சுத்தி வர்றதுக்கு எவ்வளவு நாள் ஆகுது? 30 நாள், 28, 29 நாள் ஆகுது. மொத்தம் எவ்வளவு ராசிகள் இருக்கு? 12 ராசிகள்.
The beautiful magic of bees. Thanks to Heidi Herman of the Natural Beekeeping Trust for that special insight with the biodynamic twist. You're listening to KKCR Hanalei KAQA Kilauea. This is In the Garden on the Farm, and we are listening to excerpts from a film called The Challenge of Rudolf Steiner. Right now we're going to turn to Jakes Jayakaran, the president of the Biodynamic Association of India. Let's listen.
So Jakes, can you tell me what's going on, what you're trying to convey?
So as you know, Jonathan, in biodynamics, one of the important principles is using the lunar and the astronomical positions in planning our agricultural work. All over the world, whether it was India, China, or South America, or even probably Europe, the ancient farmers were looking for auspicious days to plan their agriculture, sowing or transplanting of seedlings. But in modern times, we've sort of forgotten this thing. We think it's superstition and it is not scientifically proven and things like that. But the last century, people like Maria Thun, there was another lady, Lily Kolisko. So these people have done a lot of research over long duration, 30, 40 years, doing these sowing
planting experiments, and that has sort of proved that there is a definite correlation between the position of the moon and the other constellations in, you know, they do have an influence on agriculture. For us in India, this is very easy to, for our people to accept. But I see in Europe or even US, people say it is not, you know, still proven and things like this. So here what I'm trying to do is I'm just trying to explain to them, how to use this planting care. What do we mean by different planets? For most of us, even for me, some time back, I couldn't imagine what was Saturn or what was Venus, because we very rarely get to see them in the sky. So here we made a model with a geocentric model, with the Earth in the middle and all the planets going around. As you can see, the closest planet, apart from the Moon, which is over here, is Venus, and after that comes Mercury, and then is the Sun, and then Mars goes to Jupiter and Saturn.
And is it? It's not just a question of timing, is it? I mean, it's also which planets are connected with
which crops. Yeah, more than the planets, we say the constellations. You know, we have in every crop or in every plant, we have a leaf, a flower, a seed, and a root. But depending on the crop, in different crops, we use different parts of the plant. Like a potato, we are using the root, you know, for drinking tea. You know, we are losing the leaves, like some like roses and flowers as such, we are more interested in the flower. And in some, we are interested in the seed. So depending on what part of the plant we are interested in, we try to see where the moon is standing. So if it's a root crop, we try to see that the moon is standing, for instance, in the constellation of Taurus, or in the constellation of Virgo, or in the constellation of Capricorn. These three are Earth constellations. So when the moon is standing in front of these different constellations, the moon is beaming to the Earth more of the energies from that particular constellation. So if you are doing a root crop, it's good to do it when the moon is in Taurus or in Virgo. So this is one, the position of the moon. The other is what we call as the ascending and the descending phases of the moon, which is a little different from the waxing and the waning of the moon. The waxing and waning is to do with the full moon and the new moon cycle. But the ascending descending is another rhythm. And that's also very important as far as agriculture is concerned. Now for 14 days the moon is in an ascending phase, and then it comes down in a descending phase. Mainly because of the tilt of the Earth, you know, this 23 degree tilt, it makes what we say the planets, all the planets going around, they spend half of their orbital period, you know. Like for instance, the Moon, the orbital period is say 28 days, you know, to go around the Earth. So for 14 days, the Moon is in an ascending period, and for 14 days, it's in a descending period. Or if we take the Sun takes 12 months to go around, I mean, from a geocentric perspective. So the Sun is also 6 months in the ascending and 6 months below below the equator. You know, we project the equator on the Earth, you know, into the cosmos. And that is known as a celestial equator, you know. And because of the tilt of the Earth, it looks like all the planets are, you know, the equator is actually in a different angle. And so the planets, although they are all going in one flat plane, but from our perspective, it looks like they are above this equator for half of the time and below the equator for half of the time. And research has shown that when it is above, when it is in the ascending phase, it's a good time for sowing seeds. There's a higher percentage of germination of seeds and things like that. And if you are transplanting seedlings, it's always good in the descending period. You know, in the 14 days when the moon is in the descending phase. Because in the descending phase, there is a natural pull, gravitational pull into the earth. So when we transplant seedlings, the roots seem to have a natural tendency to, you know, go deeper down into the earth. And we believe, by using the planting calendar, we synchronize the plant growth to what we call as the cosmic rhythms, you know. So it's sort of fine-tuning it to the planetary rhythm.
When Rudolf Steiner gave these indications in his agricultural course, in one sense, I suppose, he was actually talking about what we always knew in the past, instinctively. Is that right?
I think you're 100% right, because he often mentions about farmers in China and South America and other parts of the world were using these planetary almanac calendars, yes.
So we knew this in the past.
Yes.
We've forgotten it.
Or probably we needed the modern way. We want scientific proof for everything. Even the existence of God, we need a firm, solid proof that we can, you know, touch our fingers and feel, yes, it is real. And so in the last century, I think there's a lady called Maria Thun, a very well-known lady who lives in Marburg in Germany. And she's like a world authority now on this, composing the planting calendar for every year. And she has done a lot of research based on the moon position in standing in front of the different constellations. And this lady, Lily Kolisko, has done research on the ascending and descending phases. And both the research seems to show there is a definite correlation between sowing with the planting calendar. Yeah.
So there's proof.
Yes, I think there is proof, but still it needs to be more authenticated by more researchers, probably.
Mm-hmm. Not yet proof of God.
No. Proof of God, yes. I think, we are all doubting Thomas's, you know, we want to put our finger in the... Unless I touch and can see, you know, we won't believe. Yeah.
But that's changing, don't you think?
I think the more and more we go into the scientific way of thinking and education, even our people are slowly going out of the older way of thinking, I think. At least the people in the cities I meet, they also have the Western way of thinking now with, you know, they want proofs, they disbelieve many of the old ideas. But still a lot of people are coming back to this, rediscovering it, more or less. Mm-hmm. I think we have to go, it's like we have to swing to the other side, to disbelieve, and then we swing back the pendulum.
Yeah. Perhaps wiser when we come back, do you think? Not just a repetition.
Or finding more explanations which our mind can accept. In the old days, people intuitively, felt these things, or they listened to elders, and they believed it as true. But nowadays, everyone is his own boss and no one wants to have everyone wants to read and discover things themselves. So I think we have to, help people to go that way also. You know, help them to rediscover these things.
For themselves.
Yes. But for our people here, like all of them, you know, if they were to get their daughter or son married, they would go straight to a local village, astrologer, and they will do this horoscope matching to check for compatibility, whether these two can live together, and there's never 100% compatibility. They look for 60-70%. So they're all familiar with the astrological terms. But on a physical level, they can't visualize what is Saturn, what is the constellation. Yeah, we are more earthbound. We very rarely look up at the cosmos, I think. Well, this small shed we have here is where we make the so-called biodynamic preparations. One of the differences between biodynamic agriculture and the normal, what we call as organic farming, is in BD biodynamic agriculture, we use certain preparations made from cow manure to activate the soil life, you know, the biological life in the soil, because in the last 30-40 years we've been using so much of chemicals all over in our agriculture land, the soil biolife has practically become sterilized. These fertilizers have removed most of the soil life. So we make a preparation called the BD500, made from the cow manure of a milking cow. And then we fill it in a cow horn, and then we bury it in the soil for about 6 months. And after we take it out, 6 months, we get a preparation called BD500. But in popular parlance, it's known as the horn manure, or Biodynamics 500. And the cow manure is transformed into a very nice, sweet-smelling humus-like material like this. And we use very small quantities of this to introduce the biolife. For instance, per hectare, we use the recommended quantity is only about 60 grams, 62 grams of this preparation for 1 hectare, nearly 10,000 square meters of cultivated land. But there are some special rules how you apply it. We do a thing known as potentizing. You know, we stir it clockwise and anti-clockwise in water for nearly 1 hour before it's applied in the soil. So this is one important preparation. We call it as a foundation spray. And then we also, in biodynamics, we follow this balancing of the polarities. This BD500 is used to activate the soil, the earth, earth life. And we may also make a preparation called the horn silica, made from these quartz crystals. And it's made into a very fine powder, this crystals, and then also put again into a cow horn. And this preparation, we use only 2 grams per hectare, just 2 grams. Basically, what we do is these crystals, we grind it into a very fine powder, so we actually make billions and billions of crystals. And when it's mixed in water and we spray it in the atmosphere, we don't spray it on the ground. We just spray it in the air. So it's like you release millions or billions of crystals floating in the air, you know. And then the sunlight that passes through these crystals actually gives a different kind of, you can say, a photosynthetic activity for the leaves. It gives like a boost.
So it's really a kind of healing of the earth and the
yes.
atmosphere that you're doing in a
yes.
way, isn't it?
Yes.
Like a medicine almost.
It's a very powerful medicine. Actually, we believe this gives greatly improves the quality of the produce coming from the farm. You know, we call it the quality enhancer. It improves the aroma, it improves the Brix, the sugar content. It also gives resistance to the plants, against fungus especially.
Yeah. Some people might think it sounds a bit weird, this planting in the cow horn. I mean, what's the purpose of that? Why can't you just bury it?
Actually, the cow horn is like a living medium for transforming the cow manure into this humus. Actually, it's a very long-drawn explanation why the cow horn is used, but apparently we think the cows have horns only as a defense mechanism. But Dr. Steiner mentions that it's also a way of holding the digestive forces of the cow. You know, the cow is a highly specialized animal for digestion. You know, it has 4 stomachs and it's all the time ruminating, and it looks like our earth, the soil, is having like a bad tummy ache. You know, the earth is also like one big stomach in a way. Everything, you know, gets digested, transformed, and something new comes up. The dung coming out of the cow has a lot of special bacteria, microorganisms, which help in the digestion process in the soil. The digestion energy, you can say, sort of streams upward to the cow horn and it sort of radiates back. And so this digestive force, you can say, is sort of held contained in the cow horn. And by putting the cow manure into the cow horn, you actually make this power in the cow manure much more, powerful, you can say. We also use different flowers, like for instance the yarrow flower. You see those ladies are cutting the flowers. We are going to make a special preparation from these flowers. We also use the chamomile. So each of these flowers brings certain trace elements which are missing now in our modern agricultural land, because we are using so much of chemicals. We are not putting back organic matter in the soil. The soil is sort of getting depleted of its important nutrients. And one of the reasons we believe why modern people have more allergies and different kind of health problems is because the soils are deficient in these minerals. So the food we eat that is grown from these nutrient deficient soils are also deficient in nutrients. And so we are eating mostly nutrient deficient food, you can say. And so this is a homeopathic way of bringing these nutrients back into the soil. So these are called compost preparations, because we again make different, you can say, herbal medicines, and we introduce it into compost heaps. In organic farming also they make plenty of compost heaps, but in biodynamic farming the speciality is we introduce 6 of these compost preparations into the compost heaps.
It's a family, is it?
It's a family, Jonathan. His name is Pichai, and his whole family is working on making a compost for his farm over here. So one of the activities that we do in this area is that we are trying to, we have a project called Small Farmers Empowerment Project. So we want to make these farmers, in a way, self-sufficient and not expect anything from the government or from outside help. So that's our strategy, that they have to be self-sufficient in their food. So what we are trying to do over here is we are teaching them the forgotten art of making compost. Mostly although we have a lot of cows, most people think that compost is just pure cow manure. And here what we are doing is we are teaching them to have a right balance between the carbon material, all the dried leaves, the straw. All of that is carbonaceous material. Carbon is the, you know, the building block of life. And then the other green material, they are all leguminous from trees and other fresh green material. And that has a lot of protein or nitrogenous material. So we try to get a good combination between the carbon and the nitrogen. What in agriculture they call is the CN ratio. Carbon is to nitrogen ratio. What we saw them doing earlier was that they were adding minerals. So our compost strategy is carbonaceous material, proteinaceous material, and minerals. So in the minerals, they use wood ash from their kitchen because ash has a lot of potash. And then they were using rock phosphate. Actually, rock phosphate is called superphosphate in the chemical industry. They put a lot of sulfuric acid and make it into superphosphate. So here, rock phosphate is actually a rock. It's actually mined from this thing. And the third thing they were using was rock dust. Rock dust brings a lot of minerals also into the compost heap. The method we follow is called a layering method. That means we do it in this like sandwich method, you know, different layers. So one layer of carbon, the dry leaf material, another layer of the protein nitrogen material, and then a third layer of these minerals. And then it keeps again repeating in the same pattern. And at the end, once they finish the compost heap, we'll be adding what we call as the BD compost preparations. The yarrow preparation made from the yarrow flower, the chamomile flower, the nettle, the bark of the oak tree, dandelion flowers, and the valerian officinalis the flower again of the valerian. So we make these into a kind of a homeopathic remedy, like how Dr. Steiner had taught. And at the end of the compost heap making, they add 1 gram of each of these preparations in the compost heap.
Because Steiner, of course, grew up in the countryside himself, didn't he, in Austria?
Yeah.
He knew about these things. These,
yes. But in 1920s itself, he was saying that farmers were already using a lot of chemical fertilizers in Central Europe. And he was quite critical about going in for these mineral fertilizers. He says that's a wrong direction, wrong way to go. Because by using these chemical fertilizers, you get what is known as demineralized food. You know, it is the food loses its power to give life in a way, you know, the life forces.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And he was concerned already then in the 1920s.
Yes, that was amazing. But I think in Europe you went in for chemical farming much earlier. For us, we started only in the 1960s, the last 50 years. The beauty of Dr. Rudolf Steiner is that he was not just a philosopher living in a world of ideas and just philosophizing and just thinking. He brought all these ideas to practical human activity, whether it's agriculture, education, medicine, architecture.
Wow, fascinating stuff. He's just brilliant. I love the way he breaks down the preparations and goes into detail about the ascending and descending moon cycles. That was great.
Indeed, it's nice to have somebody who really can grasp the intricacies of biodynamic farming. You know, this is a practice that we would love to see happening more and more on Kauai. I want to give a special shout out to our dear friend Marie Moje, who's been practicing that over in Molawa'a for years now. And speaking of Molawa'a, it's going to be the home of the next seed and plant exchange coming up this weekend.
On November 2nd from 12 to 5, that's this Sunday. How exciting. I've been waiting for half a year.
Well, Robin, we always look forward to the amazing gifts you share, all the plants that you bring and release out into the world in the hands of many gardeners and farmers on Kauai. We want to encourage other people to do the same and to find out more information about how you can get involved as a volunteer, what to bring, what not to bring, just as important. We want to direct you to ribg.org. That's the home of Regeneration's Botanical Garden, the host of the event. We're really looking forward to it. We're hoping for some nice weather and for you to join us.
Indeed. So just a heads up on how to get there. The Molawa Farm Lots are directly behind the Molawa Sunrise Fruit Stand on the ocean side or Makai side of the highway. And once you turn at the fruit stand, you'll see lots of signs that will direct you to the pot of gold.
And that's Ko'olau Road. It's the south end of Ko'olau Road, that turn off the highway. And again, looking forward to seeing you, looking forward to sharing a whole new year of productive gardening and hopefully a whole bunch of new plant diversity in your gardens and farms from the event. So that's about all we have time for today. We want to thank you for tuning in. And we also want to thank our engineer, Jack, our phone tech, Mac, our webmaster, Laura Christine, and our station manager, Dean, for keeping us on the air. Thank you so much to the contributors to the show, and you all make the show possible, and just mahalo to you all. This has been In the Garden on the Farm with Robin and Paul, and we want to invite you to tune in again next week for more stimulating conversation on our relationship with the life of the land that gives us life. Aloha.
Aloha.